Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anthony Brooks is out today. Well, this week, the Massachusetts House of Representatives passed its $32 billion version of the budget. And in education news, a state commission study showed more poor students are receiving special education than their higher income peers. And this afternoon in Washington, the House voted not to raise interest rates on student loans and keep them low, but they decided to pay for it by carving money out of the federal health care law. Also today, Senator Scott Brown and likely Democratic Senate opponent Elizabeth Warren released their tax records. And the records have something in common. Well, at least they both do. They've both got a lot of money.
Gail and I are very blessed to have opportunities. We've been together for 25 years and have been saving and working hard. And I want those opportunities for everybody.
Great opportunities were afforded to me. I'm in this race right now because I worry that those opportunities are being taken away.
Well, that's where we'll begin with our Friday Week in Review. And joining us to help us with that is Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist and editor of the Trotter Review. Good to see you, Ken.
Nice to be here, Meghna.
Also with us is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to see you as well, Jeff.
Hello, Meghna. Glad to be back.
It's great to have you. Well, let's start with the tax records that were released both by Senator Scott Brown. He released 6 years of tax returns. And apparently he and his wife earned around $2.5 million over that period. His Democratic challenger, Elizabeth Warren, released 4 years' worth of returns, showing she and her husband earned around $3.5 million. I note that Boston.com calls it the battle of the one percenters, Jeff. But both were quick today to point out their humble backgrounds. Let's start with Senator Brown.
People have read my book. They understand mom and dad were married and divorced 4 times each, and that I lived in 17 houses by the time I was 18, and mom was on welfare. And the fact that we've been able to be blessed by good opportunities and take advantage of those opportunities, like I said, I want everyone to have those opportunities.
And here's Elizabeth Warren.
I'm the daughter of a maintenance man who has lived the American dream. And I did that because of opportunity. I went to public schools. I got help. I was the beneficiary of student loans, and I am in this race now because I fear that America has turned in a very different direction.
So, Ken Cooper, let's start with you. First of all, how much does it matter how much Elizabeth Warren and Senator Brown are making, and what do those dollar figures tell you?
Well, I think it matters less than what they say and what they do with respect to public policy. We've had a history in this country of people like Ted Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt who were rich, and they looked after the 99%. So the question is to what extent the public policies of either candidate actually look out for the interests of the most of us.
Well, in fact, in those two bits of tape, Jeff, we were hearing that basically both Senator Brown and Elizabeth Warren are saying that they still want everyone, well, Senator Brown says he wants everyone to have those opportunities. Elizabeth Warren feels the same way but says those opportunities are being removed.
If anybody thought that the release of their tax records were somehow going to change the rhetoric that each candidate engages in, the way that they try to appeal to voters that they think will be more congenial to their worldview, then, you know, anybody who thought that was smoking something. I got to say, I find it so disheartening that we have to listen over and over and over again to this artificial division between the 1% and the 99%. It's a meaningless distinction, and to hear them, you know, play into it, to have even headlines that play into it, just reinforces something that I think is very unhealthy. Terrific that they're successful. It's great that they made a lot of money. Let's hope, you know, everybody's got a chance to make a lot of money. The idea that somehow this should be also used as a way to try to drive a wedge between people, or to that they should feel the need to try to rebut any suggestion that they're privileged but other people, you know, are being deprived of it. I don't know. I just find the whole thing so odious.
Well, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's quite the characterization of the argument that's really at play. What's at play here is that the people in the 1% out of 5% or the 10%, you can pick your number, it doesn't have to be arbitrary, aren't paying their fair share of taxes. They make their money and they get to keep it. The other people are struggling to make it and they got to pay. That's the issue, tax fairness. It's not that they have that they earn or that they succeeded and others did not and wish to is that they're not paying their fair share of taxes under the current tax code.
Well, I know that that's the argument, and when we could certainly have a robust discussion. I mean, anybody who looks at this thing can easily and quickly determine that the top 1% pay a vastly larger share of the taxes than any other than an enormous chunk of taxpayers elsewhere in the country. What is it? You know, the top 1% pay something like 27% of the taxes that are collected, but. The point is, if you're going to focus on the amount of money that they make, it seems to me that more interesting than trying to use it as a way to score a psychological point against them in this class warfare rhetoric, it'd be more interesting to talk about what do they do with the money that they make. The 1%, you know, it strikes me as interesting that neither of these two candidates, whose families make a ton of money, especially in recent years, gives more than, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3% of their income to charity. Personally, I'd be embarrassed if I got caught giving that little to charity. Mitt Romney gave something like 18 or 19% of his income to charity. How is it that somebody like Elizabeth Warren and her husband, who make close to $1 million, give such a tiny pittance? I would find that more interesting and maybe more illuminating to talk about.
But what does it have to do with public policy?
Well, let me just jump in here for a second and note that, first of all, Mitt Romney makes multiple the times income that someone like Senator Brown or Elizabeth Warren does. And I wanted to actually step back here for a second and ask, you know, in a sense, this makes them both, I mean, Senator Brown's already in the Senate, but it also makes Elizabeth Warren well-suited for the Senate because, quite frankly, being a millionaire is kind of par for the course regarding those people who have been elected to the United States Senate. I mean, we have our other senator, John Kerry, who obviously is fairly well-heeled himself. But that's what one of the questions that I'm wondering, because we have half of the Congress in the form of the Senate who's full of the 1%, and essentially most
that's
of
true.
Them are.
That's true.
So let me turn this quickly to you, Jeff, and then to you, Ken. I mean, for that sense, do you think that it doesn't matter that we know in a little bit more detail, as you were saying, not just how much they make, but what they're spending it on? I mean, is it not a fair window into what they might do as elected representatives for Massachusetts?
What they do with their own money as a window into what they would do if they were elected, I don't know. I mean, people seem to be a lot more willing to spend, at least some people seem to be a lot more willing to spend other people's money than they are to spend their own money. So I don't know that you can make that one-on-one connection. Your first point, that both of these candidates are very wealthy, that they seem to be typical of people who run for the U.S. Senate and for Congress in general, I think is very relevant. We have got a political system now in which you essentially cannot run for high office, with few exceptions, unless you've got a tremendous amount of money of yourself or access to a tremendous amount of money from donors. If that's something that we're concerned about, I think it ought to be a bipartisan concern. It's neither Republicans nor Democrats that have got a monopoly, and it's neither Republicans nor Democrats that benefit from having wealthy candidates who are able to then, you know, vault themselves into higher office.
Ken, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is a place where Jeff and I agree.
Uh-oh.
Although I think if we talked about solutions, we probably would part company. But it is true that the Senate is dominated by wealthy people. The House is not so uniformly dominated by the wealthy. There are people of modest means there.
Although to run for a House seat, unless it's uncontested, you need a fortune of money as well.
You need, you know, a few $100,000 at least.
It seems beginning to be more and more every year.
Yeah.
But your point was, Ken?
But there are people there who are of modest means. And I think, you know, that's not good for the country, particularly with the Senate, given its power to block things, to block change. And, you know, to change that kind of situation, you got to talk about public financing, where I think Jeff and I would probably disagree.
We probably would.
All right. Well, let's move on, if we can, to another issue of financial interest. And that is, of course, federal student loan interest rates. Just a few hours ago in Washington, the House of Representatives passed a bill that will actually hold student loan rates, the interest rates there, at their current state. It will keep them from doubling, which was set to happen soon. But the House has decided to pay for that by taking money previously dedicated to the federal health care law. President Barack Obama, because of that, has indicated he would veto this bill. So, Jeff, first of all, what's your take on how this student loan issue has developed over this past week?
I got to say, I'm a little bit surprised at what apparently potent political issue the Obama campaign regards this as. To me, it was clear all along that Congress is going to continue the existing rate. I've got serious problems about federal financial aid, tuition assistance in the first place. My column this weekend is about how even as Congress shovels more and more and more and more money into it, tuition keeps going up and up and up, and that maybe it's time politicians started noticing that there's a cause and effect relationship
well,
between
the
two. Well,
in fact, Elizabeth Warren herself in the
she
past
used to say that,
has
right.
said that.
The Globe had a story the other day quoting from one of her books. I think it was Two-Income Trap was the name of her book, in which she points out the more, you know, the government shovels into financial aid for students to make college affordable, the more unaffordable college seems to become, because colleges essentially use this as an opportunity to harvest as much money from taxpayers as they can. You go to the White House website, at least as of early this morning when I checked, or you go to the White House Twitter account, and they've got this big "Don't Double My Rate" emblem. The president gave speeches on college campuses last week. He went on one of the late night comedy shows, all promoting this issue. I gather that his pollsters and his experts must say this is a tremendously powerful political issue.
How can it not be? Student loan
because
debt is greater than credit card debt in America.
Because it's clear
now
that Republicans and Democrats alike, whatever the wisdom of the loan program, are going to vote to extend the low rate. There was never any question that the rate was going to be raised.
All right, Ken, your thoughts.
Well, I don't know about there never was any question. Early this month, the House Republicans voted for a federal budget that would have let the Stanford loan rates double. So there was some doubt about it, and there is some equivocation about it. I would say that when it comes to the impact, and I speak from one who has been a beneficiary of these programs and wouldn't have gone to college without them, that I think the analysis they drive up tuition is actually not correct. And what drives up tuition, in fact, is demand from parents and families for creature comforts on campus.
That's part of it.
That's a big part of it. The
two are connected. That pushes up what colleges call their costs. Costs can include, a jacuzzi in every dorm room. Cost, when they talk about the cost of educating a student or the cost of higher education, anything that a college spends money on gets fed into it. And they then turn around. In fact, I just read a speech that was given recently by Stephen Joel Trachtenberg, the former president of George Washington University, who was telling an audience that because tuition goes up, parents demand more and more amenities. It's this vicious cycle that keeps feeding each other, and it's all enabled or largely enabled by the government assistance programs.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, the government assistance programs, we're talking about student loans as a bulk of them. They're not gifts. People pay them back, and they pay interest. This is not gift. What the government does is subsidize the interest rates. Most federal financial assistance is loans that students pay back. And the reason we subsidize it is because education is an individual benefit and a public good. Colleges are the place where this country produces its leaders for business, for government, and communities. And there's a public interest in that, and that's why we subsidize it.
No question about the value of college. Washington spends tens of billions of dollars more than $100 billion every year on these programs. The loans themselves, you make it sound as though it doesn't add up to anything. First of all, the subsidies of those loans add up to billions of dollars. And the grants, there are a huge number of grant programs, and there are tax credits and tax deductions.
The Pell Grant is the biggest one. Is the Pell Grant program, which is a modest program. It's only for low and moderate income people. And you can't pay for college with a Pell Grant unless you're going to a community college. You cannot afford a four-year degree only with Pell Grants. It does not happen.
Okay, so let me just jump back in here, because this is actually a terrific conversation. And to me, who, as one, I don't know about you gentlemen, but as one who is still paying off her college loans, I mean, the other issue that seems to come to mind here is that, yes, absolutely, there has been a great deal of conversation around the fact that for as long as there's some form of government assistance regarding college education, that's one of the factors that doesn't necessarily encourage colleges and universities to do anything to control the tuition rate, the rate of their tuition increase. The other issue that I find that sort of goes along with that is, well, sheer supply and demand. Okay, so there's a lot of students and a lot of colleges, and they're all competing for a fixed number of spots. But the thing that I wanted to actually point out was that, for example, Gail Collins in the New York Times wrote recently that, hey, we have a generation of students that the second they graduate from college are putting a huge fraction of their monthly income, if they're lucky enough to have one in this economy, to paying those student loans. And here are the same people that, in her words, we expect to eventually maybe get a mortgage to help that side of the economy. She doesn't see them buying houses anytime soon. So I want to get back to this issue of, like, this is a potent political issue, not just for young people, but I would do you not think for the economy as a whole, for where America wants to see itself in 10 years?
Maybe I didn't speak clearly before. What I meant was the specifics of the interest rate for the Stafford Loan Program and what Congress and when Congress and how Congress will extend it, that has been turned into a political issue in the past week surprised me. I think that it would be an extremely valuable conversation and well worth having a big, heated political debate, Republicans, Democrats, Obama, Romney, about how or if it should be the job of the government to finance or to subsidize or to support students in higher education and whether making college affordable, quote unquote, really is a job for the government or whether that's a job more effectively handled by a robust economy.
All right, Ken, last thought from you on this?
Well.
Last thought of, I'm sure, many.
All I'll say is that I'm sure it's a potent issue, and it's a part of the way that the Obama administration, the Obama campaign, is appealing to young voters, which were a very important part of their victory 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're pushing it so hard. It's also important to the parents of those young people, because if the students can't afford the loans and parents take them, they cost even more. I heard the other day a friend, and I don't know how this happened, must have been in the private market, the son had a college loan that was interest rate was 33%.
I mean, For a private loan?
Yeah. I mean, it's outstanding. This is a potent issue. People care about this.
And it's one that we will almost certainly return to frequently over the coming months. But before we run out of time, I do want to touch upon one other story regarding education here in Massachusetts. And that is that a State Commission study this week revealed that Massachusetts ranks second in the nation, just behind Rhode Island, when it comes to the percentage of students enrolled in special education. And the rate is highest amongst low-income districts here in the Commonwealth. So we've got a little bit of tape here from State Education Commissioner Mitchell Chester.
I'm very concerned that in many districts we have an over-reliance on special education. In some of our districts, as many as one out of four students are being identified with a disability. And if, in fact, these students are not disabled and are not benefiting from these special ed services, then this is money that's not paying off in terms of a strong education for the students.
Okay, Ken Cooper, your first thoughts on this study.
Well, it is a little bit surprising that the state ranks so high. And as I've thought about this story, I have further questions. I would like to see some data on the demographics of the teaching forces in both Massachusetts and Rhode Island contrasted with the demographics of student bodies. Because I suspect one of the things that's going on here is you have a mismatch demographically between who's standing in front of the classroom and the students before them. And those teachers may not always be able to handle, understand, appreciate, manipulate those students into high performance, and so they take the easy way out, send them out the door, down the hall to the special ed class.
We spoke with some special ed advocates this week on Radio Boston. They said you could actually look at these numbers as one sign of the success of Massachusetts special education law, that this is one means by which students who need help are able to get it. But the question does remain, is it the right students?
I think there's a lot of special ed overuse in low-income communities and in high-income communities. I remember the Globe some years ago doing a big, one of these big enterprise journalism stories that showed parents in very well-to-do communities knowing exactly how to manipulate the system and pressure the system so that their kid who wasn't learning that well in class would get extra help at taxpayer expense.
But this is one of those things that this study seemed to contradict, that the rate was actually much higher in low-income communities, and it wasn't necessarily those parents seeking special ed assistance.
Right. No, I understand, and I'm saying it because my point is that there's been evidence and there have been studies suggesting that you get overuse essentially across the board. And while I don't minimize the importance of special education, kids who are genuinely handicapped do need special help with education. But all too often, and I think this is maybe saying some of what Ken was saying in a different way, it's a question of not so much a need for special education, but a need for effective education. And if you have teachers who aren't very good, and frankly, in a lot of schools, teachers aren't very good, and it's just seniority and promotions and the automatic ladder of union memberships that protects them and keeps them in the classroom, it might sometimes be easier to say, I don't know what to do with that kid. Let's just send him off into special ed. Or it might be, something that is better handled by effective discipline, not so much an educational issue. Or it might be a matter of parental involvement, and parents aren't often as involved as they should be. There's so much that gets wrapped up in this, and it's hard for people to talk about it without getting very emotional.
Well, on that point, we're going to have to move on finally to our weekly hubbubs in the last 2 minutes or so we have in this conversation, and that's the story that maybe didn't make it to the front page or top of mind this week. Ken, your hubbub.
Yeah, sort of behind the scenes in Roxbury here in Boston, there's planning underway, just beginning to identify and develop a cultural district, which is likely to be somewhere in the Dudley Square area, where the city of Boston is going to renovate the Ferdinand Furniture Building and move the school department in there, and you'll have more people working there. And perhaps if the cultural district is in the same vicinity, you may have a different kind of stimulus going on there.
Interesting. Jeff, you're a hubbub.
Something a little bit different. In 1917, a boy named William Lawless Pace was accidentally shot in the head by his brother, who was fooling around with a rifle. In 1917, medical technology was much less than what it was, and doctors didn't know what to do about this kid with the bullet in his brain. They figured it would be much too dangerous to try to take the bullet out. You've heard about a hole in the head. You've heard about a splitting headache. William Pace died this week at the age of 103. So when you think that things couldn't possibly be any worse for you than they are, think about this guy who lived an entire life, and apparently from the obituary this week, a fairly active life with a bullet in his head for most of the last 103 years.
That is totally remarkable. 103. Wow. Well, my hubbub has to do with a fellow named Kyle Chaney. He may not be known to a lot of our listeners, but he's known to us here in the media and journalism business because for many years he worked for the State House News Service, and they are the people who spend all day and all night up at the State House telling us what the truth is going on with the Massachusetts legislature. Kyle is moving on to Politico, which is a great gain for Politico. You'll be talking about health care and health reform. But I have to say it's a loss for us because he is a terrific reporter, and the Massachusetts State House News Service is better for it. And Kyle, best of luck to you. We love the State House News Service, and we'll keep paying attention to what you have to say at Politico. So that is my hubbub this week. Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor of the Trotter Review, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
And Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you, as always.
Great to be here. Thanks.
All right. Well, up next, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.